From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we want to start right in on Attorney General William Barr's move last night in a memo to federal prosecutors to give them authorization to investigate specific instances of voter fraud. Barr also warned that specious, speculative, fanciful, or far-fetched claims should not be a basis for initiating federal inquiries. So what does that mean? Trevor Potter is founder and president of the Nonpartisan Campaign Legal Center, former chair of the Federal Election Commission, as well as general counsel to the late John McCain's two presidential bids. Trevor Potter, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Robin. It's great to be with you.
And as you well know, immediately, Richard Pilger, head of the Justice Department's Election Crimes Branch, resigned in protest over AG Barr's letter to prosecutors. What do you make of it when you heard of the letter?
Well, first of all, the resignation tells us that this is something that career Justice Department people think is wrong. The reason for that is that elections are run at the state level, and there is no federal role here in the states determining who won. So this is a departure from department policy. I will say that the Attorney General made it clear that, first of all, this was an authorization for prosecutors to look, not a command that they must do so. But secondly, he said only in those cases where the alleged violations could affect the result of the election. Let me give you an example of a specific allegation. In Nevada, the Trump campaign alleged that there were at least 3,000 Nevadans who had illegally voted, saying that they had voted in the election even though they had filed change of address forms to out of state. And I mention that because here's what we now know about Nevada. They alleged there were 3,000 illegal voters. The margin in Nevada is far larger than that. So even if true, those 3,000 voters would not affect the election. Then it turned out when they released the list that many of the voters on that list were military and allowed under Nevada law to vote in Nevada while they were posted out of state. Some of them were college students who reside in Nevada and were in college out of state. They too are allowed to vote. So the point is, you can make allegations of fraud. That doesn't mean they are proven. So I think that tells you that Barr is authorizing, whether because of pressure from Trump or whatever reason, he is authorizing his prosecutors to look at such allegations. It doesn't mean that they're going to come up with anything, and it certainly doesn't mean they would be large enough to affect the election result in any state, but it's still unprecedented.
I know you want to talk about Pennsylvania. The administration is alleging there that Republican observers weren't allowed to get close enough to where the election workers were counting ballots. This could have been because of social distancing measures. What else did you want us to know about Pennsylvania?
That suit is different because it's in federal court. It could conceivably go to the Supreme Court, and it asks for the sort of relief we have never imagined out of a federal court in an election in this country.
And of course, the fear is that if anything goes to the Supreme Court, it's a Supreme Court in which President Trump has three appointees. Just briefly, the Republican Party seems to be cannibalizing itself here. In Georgia, the Republican senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler are calling on Georgia's Republican Secretary of State to step down. They say there was voter fraud there. He says that's laughable. But again, he's a Republican. You have, you know, the Republican governors and attorney generals and other secretaries of state in other states saying, we are Republicans. We do this well. Do you see, just to be clear, Trevor, do you see anything anywhere in any of the claims that would amount to the kind of fraud that could overturn this election?
No, I do not. So far, we have seen nothing that is either of the sort of the character or the size that would constitute fraud sufficient to overturn the election in any of these states. I think what you're seeing here is not Republican versus Republican. You are seeing the professionals of both parties who are responsible for running elections and feel they did a remarkably good job in the middle of a pandemic with none of the disasters that were predicted, suddenly being attacked by ideologically motivated politicians with no evidence at all saying it's all fraudulent. And they find that personally offensive and professionally offensive and dangerous to the country because it suggests to the public, particularly Trump voters, that somehow a Biden election, if that's where we end up, as seems likely, is illegitimate. And that may be Trump's goal, but it is certainly not the goal of the professionals of both parties who run elections and rely on public confidence in their work.
By the way, do you mind if I ask, are you Republican?
I am historically Republican. I have worked for Republican candidates for many offices. I'm currently running a nonprofit, which is nonpartisan.
Trevor Potter, founder and president of the Campaign Legal Center, that nonprofit. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin, very much.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard the latest legal challenge to the Affordable Care Act today. At issue is whether the individual mandate is constitutional. That's the provision requiring people to maintain a minimum amount of health insurance coverage, and a ruling against it could put the health care of more than 20 million people at risk. The new 6-3 conservative majority on the court will also be closely watched as this case plays out. Joining us now is Larry Levitt. He's executive vice president for health policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Larry, welcome.
Thank you.
And the key legal term in this case here is severability. And today, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh both suggested that the rest of the law could stand if the individual mandate fell. How do you interpret what you heard today?
Well, many people, including me, came away from today's oral arguments thinking that there might be a majority on the court, including Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh, to support the idea that even if the individual mandate is unconstitutional, the rest of the ACA shouldn't be thrown out as well. You always have to be careful interpreting these oral arguments because the justices often play devil's advocate and, push arguments that they may not agree with just to see how the attorneys will answer them. But particularly Kavanaugh and Roberts seem to suggest that they weren't prepared to throw out the whole law.
The issue of the intent or will of Congress also came up quite a few times today. What can you tell us about that?
That's right. And this case, it's a little hard to get your head around this case. Back in 2012, when the Supreme Court first considered the Affordable Care Act, they ruled that the individual mandate was constitutional, not because it was okay for the federal government to require people to buy insurance or command them to do so, but because that's not really what the ACA did. The ACA gave people a choice. You could either buy insurance or pay a tax penalty to the federal government. What is different now is that Congress in 2017 got rid of the tax penalty. They set the tax penalty to zero. So there's no longer a tax penalty associated with the individual mandate. So there's some question as to whether the individual mandate itself is now unconstitutional. It's a toothless individual mandate with no penalty. And then the question is, if you throw the individual mandate out, what was the intent of Congress when it did set that tax penalty to zero? Did it really intend to, throw the entire law out, including protections for people with pre-existing conditions? Or do you go back, way back to 10 years ago when the ACA originally passed, when most people believed that the individual mandate was, in fact, central to making the law work?
Well, as you say, this is not the first time the Affordable Care Act has come before the Supreme Court, but it is the first time that there's been a 6-3 conservative majority, and it's definitely the first time that Justice Amy Coney Barrett has heard a case on Obamacare. What did you see from her today?
All the justices asked very good questions, including Justice Barrett. She also seemed to express some skepticism around issues of standing, whether, these plaintiffs even have the ability to bring the suit. Are they really harmed by an individual mandate with no penalty? But totally reading between the lines, it felt like she was inclined to throw the law out. But, you really can't tell a lot from these oral arguments always.
Yeah, we're going to have to wait and to hear how they rule, of course. The other change is that a Democrat, Joe Biden, will be in the White House when this ruling does finally come down. And we don't yet know the makeup of Congress after this election. So depending on the outcome at the Supreme Court, what do you think is next?
Well, this one of the things that made this case a political lightning rod was that President Trump supported the case to throw the ACA out rather than defending the ACA as a federal law, which would be much more typical. President-elect Biden, of course, supports the ACA and has vowed to build on it. But, you know, as president, Joe Biden couldn't just unilaterally make this case go away. Congress could. I mean, there are several easy legislative fixes Congress could pass to make this case moot. But those fixes likely depend on Democrats being in charge in the Senate. So, you know, the future of the ACA could come down to these two Senate runoffs in Georgia in January.
And we'll keep an eye on it if it does. Larry Leavitt, Executive Vice President for Health Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you very much for your insight. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
More than 10 million people in the United States have tested positive for COVID-19. And as that number soars, so does demand for testing. But what kind of tests are available and how reliable are they? We're joined now by Dr. Daniel Rhodes. He's the section head of microbiology at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. He's on Skype. Dr. Rhodes, welcome, and thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Peter. It's good to be here.
Yeah, so there are three types of tests, and let's start by briefly ticking through each one of them. How about the molecular test, or it's otherwise known as the PCR test?
Sure, yeah. So the molecular test looks for the viral RNA. So the coronavirus has RNA as its genome instead of DNA, and so we use different molecular tests to try to detect if that's in somebody's specimen. So PCR is the most common molecular test, and it's generally considered the gold standard because it's the most sensitive.
And is this the one that is most likely to be the nasal swab inside the nose?
Yep. This is a nasal swab. You know, early on in March, they were doing throat swabs, but now pretty much everybody's doing a nasal swab.
And you say it's the gold standard. How accurate is it?
So when it's positive, you know, it's very accurate. You know, there's still a subset of patients who have disease and are going to test negative. We've realized that's the case. You know, if there's viral RNA in the sample, it's going to pick it up.
All right. So then there's the antigen test, otherwise known as the rapid test. What about that one?
So the antigen tests are different in a few ways. You still need a swab, but you can't get a swab just at the front of the nose. You need to get as much virus as you can on that swab. So they go all the way to the back of the nose. That's the nasopharyngeal swab. And also, oftentimes, the specimen's completely used up in the test. You know, it's kind of once and done. But it's very quick, you know, which is why people like it.
So here's what I don't understand. You know, your hospital, you're doing 1,000 tests a day, right? How do you decide which patient should get an antigen test or a molecular test? And me as a patient, if I were to get one of those tests, like, how would I know which one I'm getting? It doesn't matter.
So at the Cleveland Clinic, we're not currently using antigen testing. We've put our effort into ramping up the PCR platforms. But it's always good to start with the goal. You know, is the goal to be quick? Or is the goal to be as sensitive as possible? Or is the goal to be as cheap as possible? So if you want to be as sensitive as possible, then you want to do a PCR test. If you have somebody with symptoms and you're pretty sure they have COVID and you want a really quick result, then an antigen test is a reasonable approach.
I see. And tell me about these spit tests. Where do they fit in to all this?
Sure. So all the spit tests currently are PCR tests.
The gold standard.
Yeah. So it's another way to try to get the virus into the tube. So this whole spit test came about because early on, and still we're having supply chain issues, but early on the problem was getting enough swabs to even collect specimens. So people, you know, started 3D printing swabs or saying maybe we don't need a swab at all. Maybe if somebody just spits in the tube, we'll be able to detect the virus. And again, it depends on the goals. It depends on the constraints of the lab. So, you know, everything has a place. It's just, you know, where does it fit?
Okay. And some people might be thinking if I get a spit test, well, maybe that's not quite as accurate as getting the swab up the nose. But it sounds like you're saying that the spit test is a molecular test, which is the gold standard, which is pretty reliable.
So it's nothing's easy these days. So it depends. It also depends how the specimen's collected. So, you know, one of my colleagues did a study, and you know, they did enhanced saliva. So, you know, they kind of snort and then you cough and then you spit it out into the tube. But there is the potential that saliva testing could be as good as a nasal swab if it's collected the right way and tested the right way.
Well, I don't want to forget about the third type of test. Of course, that is the antibody test, which tells you if you've been infected at some point along the way with the coronavirus. Tell me about those and why that's important if in many or all cases you're no longer showing symptoms of the disease.
Yeah, so we're also asking ourselves that, you know, when do we use an antibody test? How is that helpful clinically? So one measure they can look at is antibody response. So it's helpful for vaccine studies. It's also helpful for prevalence studies to see how many people may have gotten sick and never gotten a test in the first place. So for epidemiological purposes or surveillance purposes, it can provide interesting information about the public.
Hmm. And tell me if I'm wrong, but that's a blood test, right?
Yep, that's a blood test. Although, you know, people are looking at, you know, can you detect antibodies in saliva? I mean, people are always looking for a new way, a better way to do testing.
Well, early in the pandemic, we were concerned because there weren't enough tests, and the results that we did have were taking a really long time to process. Now, you know, speaking from personal experience, my family just got a test result this weekend in a little more than a day. As a country, how are we doing right now in terms of testing? Are we where we need to be?
That's a good question. You have lots of good questions. So we're definitely better off than we were in March or April or May, but it's not at all smooth yet. You know, every day I'm personally dealing with, you know, crises in the laboratory. Do we have enough pipette tips? Did that shipment come in so that we can keep testing on that test system? So we're in a much better place than we were, but I don't think anybody would say we're where we need to be yet.
Dr. Daniel Rhodes, section head of microbiology at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. Doctor, I was hoping to have really easy answers here.
Unfortunately, nothing is easy these days.
It's true, but you know what? That was very helpful and clarifying. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Well, Democrats had hoped to turn Texas blue in the 2020 election, but as we know, that did not happen. President-elect Joe Biden lost the state by about 6 points, and Republicans actually gained support in southern Texas along the U.S. border with Mexico, an area that's really pretty reliably blue. Valerie Gonzalez is a reporter with the Monitor newspaper in McAllen, Texas, and she's been gathering some local reaction near the border there. Valerie, welcome. Good to speak with you.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, and as I said, counties along the Texas border, traditionally pretty Democratic, but the support eroded this time around. What happened?
It caught everyone off guard. I don't think that either party, from speaking to them before the election, expected the results that we got. I think everybody felt that this was an awakening.
Well, the Republican Party, let's just tick through some of the numbers here to give people context. The Republican Party made significant gains in the Rio Grande Valley. In Starr County, the president got 47% of the vote this year, compared to just 19% of the vote in 2016 against Hillary Clinton. Republicans must be thrilled. What are you hearing from them?
You know, I spoke to the Republican chair in Starr County, and he didn't realize what the turnout would be until the second week of early voting. That's when he started realizing that there were more and more people who were going over to him and telling him that they had voted for Trump, that he started to realize they were going to make a significant gain in their support this year. So it was unexpected for everyone.
But do you have any sense of why? Because in Florida, for instance, we saw Latino voters, people of Cuban descent, for instance, break in favor of President Trump. The reason was because the message about Democrats being socialists seemed to resonate there in Florida. But why in Texas, along the border, where many of the people are of Mexican descent, why did Trump do so well there? Does anyone have any theories?
Yeah, you know, I think that a lot of people think that immigration is going to be something that really stands out to the Mexican-American voter, but that's not really the case, or at least not in Starr County, where the community is sustained by three main employers, the city, the county, and the school district. And if you don't get a job with them, you have to travel further to find a job. And a lot of people there work in the oil industry. So when they heard that Biden was kind of wavering in his support for the oil industry and his support for the renewable energy, that definitely caused concern for people there with those jobs. But when we hear about immigration on a greater scale, things like the migrant protection protocols or the Remain in Mexico program, those things are a little further away from home. So they tend to focus more on what affects them directly. And what affects them the most is job security.
And you're referring to the policy that the Trump administration put into place that requires migrants applying for asylum in the United States to wait, in many cases, many months on the Mexican side of the border. You also note that in Hidalgo County, turnout was lower than in the northern part of the state, so that's going to have Democrats very concerned. And I also want to ask you about a trip that you took to Mexico, to Matamoros, just over the border, soon after the Associated Press called the race for Joe Biden. Here's a clip from one of the migrants you spoke with. His name is Danilo, and he's from Honduras.
Que vean en Estados Unidos, verdad, pues, que lo que hace Trump no es bueno. No es bueno.
In English, he's saying there the U.S. should see that what Trump did was not good. Did you get a sense of relief from people in those camps when they looked at the election results?
Yes. Migrants follow the news very closely. So they know what Biden's platform is, and they're hoping that he acts on it soon so that they can go ahead and go through their asylum court hearings.
What has Biden said about his policy for those migrants in those camps?
Well, he said he would end MPP within the first 100 days, and migrants will definitely be holding him to that.
All right, I'm sure they will be. Valerie Gonzalez, a reporter with the Monitor newspaper in McAllen, Texas, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
We're about 8 months into the pandemic in the U.S., and the retail industry is still adapting, the coronavirus changing the way Americans shop, maybe forever. And that means American mainstays, department stores, other mall-based retailers are rethinking the way they reach customers. Let's bring in Robin Farzad, a host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hello.
Let's start with one of those mainstays. JCPenney struck a deal in bankruptcy court yesterday, saving some 60,000 jobs. One of several retailers, including J. Crew, Neiman Marcus, Brooks Brothers, to file for bankruptcy in the pandemic. But how does saving those jobs and, you know, coming through bankruptcy help in the long term?
You know, the alternative was a spiral into liquidation, which not only would have erased tens of thousands of JCPenney jobs, but it would also have inundated the retail property market with all of that empty space just when it least needed that. So you saw players with typically differing strategic interests kind of hold their nose and unite just to buy this brand and themselves more time.
Right. But, you know, big box stores and places and, you know, malls have been dying for years. You know, many are now having to close almost entirely during the pandemic. But what's to say that, this decline of malls isn't going to keep happening?
Yeah, I mean, what's your reason for going to the mall right now? And if we're talking Black Friday, are you going to brave COVID worries to fight for those doorbusters? Amazon and others, they're matching online anyway. So prior to the pandemic, as you know, we were well into the obsolescence of the American mall. We've talked about Sears, old record stores, Radio Shack. The value proposition of that communal experience was just diminishing. And we know that mall operators have been scrambling to make a better case. Carousels, rock climbing, food halls. And that's all up in the air thanks to everything that has happened since March.
Well, there's partnerships happening. Target is announcing it's partnering with Ulta Beauty to build Ulta shops within the Target stores. You know, maybe Ulta's hoping to cash in. Maybe Target is. What's happening there?
Yeah, they offer one another something unique right now. Target actually has had a great year. It's an essential business that has mainly stayed open with all of those omni-channel bells and whistles, fulfillment, delivery, returns, online. Ulta, until the pandemic, was one of the hottest niche players in all of retail. But think about how impossible face-to-face contact and perfume spraying and makeup brushes have been. Yeah. So now they need the feet already in the door at Target. And Target, frankly, it could do worse than to share its overhead with a hot retail brand. We've already seen them do that with CVS and Starbucks.
Yeah. Look, a new report, serious real estate report, showed that 89% of major chains paid their rent in October. That's the highest level since the pandemic started. But Robin, I'm going to give too much information here, but I've been wearing the same Athleta pants for 8 months. You know, I just went through summer clothes and realized hadn't worn any of them. And we're hearing of a surge coming. You know, people really aren't buying clothes, are they?
I mean, they're wearing the same things. It's about keeping the leases together. Landlords have had to shell out so much rent relief this year just to keep tenants. So even that number that you're seeing, 89% of rents being paid, do we know how many renegotiations were done? Do we know how many movie chains are involved in this? Home improvement has been great. It's not just about apparel. It's about averting an outright commercial real estate depression by these landlords.
But I have divulged too much, haven't I? Wearing the same
pants. It's all right. We're all in sweatpants. We're all in athleisure wear.
I hear you're not wearing any pants. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you.
My pleasure.
President-elect Biden is forging ahead planning a coronavirus response. And for public health expert Dr. Lina Wen, that can't come soon enough. Her recent Washington Post op-ed makes it clear. She writes, Biden's top priority must be to level with the American people and tell us the hard truths. It's titled, President Biden, Get to Work. Dr. Wen is an emergency physician and public health professor at George Washington University. She previously served as Baltimore's health commissioner. She's a frequent contributor to CNN and Here and Now. So, Dr. Wen, Lina, welcome back.
Nice to talk to you, as always, Robin.
Yeah, let's get right to it. You say Biden needs to start having fireside chats like Roosevelt did, put his health experts on daily briefings. What else?
Well, the most important thing right now is this idea that we cannot wait. Between now and January 20th, we could have more than 2,000 people a day dying from coronavirus. We've already wasted 8-9 months due to inaction, and we just cannot wait. And so President-elect Biden can actually do a lot, because what he doesn't have in executive power, he does have in moral authority. And so being able to speak directly to the American people is a major start. Because he can convince and needs to start enlisting trusted messengers who can also help to convey that message for him as well. In addition, he can come up with a national plan and get the buy-in now from governors and mayors. He may not have the executive power, but they do. And so he can start having this national framework in place that, of course, we should have had a long time ago. But that work doesn't need to wait until January 20th.
Well, you say also if he reaches out, let's say, to mayors, it gives them cover. If he not only reaches out, but starts talking about the mandates that he wants to put in place or wants them to put in place, then it gives them cover to do it if a governor has not.
That's right. I think it's particularly important in areas where the mayors or county executives may want to do the right thing or have been trying to do the right thing. They've been trying to put into place mask mandates or have been trying to do restrictions on certain types of high-risk businesses, but are finding that mayors and county executives in other surrounding areas are not doing this. And that's why that piecemeal approach has been so harmful. This is an opportunity now for President-elect Biden to get the buy-in from as many governors and mayors as possible, many of whom are already trying to do the right thing, get them to come together, have a national strategy around things like testing, contact tracing, getting supplies. He can put into place all these various pieces now, and again, not wait until January 20th.
Look, speaking to the urgency that we hear in your voice, Ashish Jha, the dean at Brown School of Public Health, says, as you do, we're on track to go from 1,000 deaths a day to 2,000 by December. As families gather, people drop their guard. But he's directing his ire and his tweets at people, asking them to make these demands of President Trump. You know, tell the Trump administration, do your job. We pay them, is one of the things he's written. Are you expecting a lot from Biden, who isn't in office yet, as we are hearing, doesn't have access to tools that he might need? Probably if he has fireside chats or has a task force speaking every day, it won't be picked up by Fox, which, you know, is where Trump supporters are getting their information and don't believe, as we know, largely don't believe in masks. I mean, what can he do with people who won't listen to him?
You make a very good point that you can have the best policies in place, but they're not going to have much effect if people don't literally follow that guidance. And that's why I hope that President-elect Biden will do a lot more to enlist those in particular who did not support him politically. So reaching out on the local community level to pastors, to heads of chambers of commerce, there are so many individuals who really can reach the communities and help to convince people to change their behaviors. Because in the absence of federal action right now, that's all we have. We need to convince people that we need to get through this winter. We have to keep up wearing masks, avoiding indoor gatherings. And this is going to be so hard as the weather gets colder and holidays come. But we have to get through this winter. Next winter will look very different. We might well have a vaccine. We may well have multiple therapeutics. But we have to get through this winter, or else there's not going to be another one to celebrate with our loved ones.
Yeah. You also say the president should appoint right now a coronavirus czar, specifically to also handle things like production of equipment that first-line workers need, also a way of distributing the vaccine that may be on the horizon. It's one thing to maybe get one made, but we don't have a distribution system yet, so that person could take that on. But I'm just wondering, we only have about a minute and a half here. I've kind of been harping on this, but it feels like the one thing that's different from this and other health crises is we can't see it. And I know, you know, that there's privacy issues and such fear of infection. You can't have camera crews wandering through hospitals to see people struggling to breathe, one of the most frightening things you'll ever see. But how do we address that? People don't believe it because they, you know, to a large extent, they can't see it.
I think that's a critical point. And in fact, we've seen that in places where coronavirus has run rampant, that communities have a much higher likelihood of abiding by things like mask mandates. I just hope that we don't wait until even more families are suffering. And it's not even from, not only just from people who are dying, it's also from people, hundreds of thousands, potentially people who could be living with long-term effects from coronavirus, effects including strokes and kidney damage and heart damage. I mean, this is the true toll of coronavirus.
Yeah. Dr. Lina Nguyen, a professor of public health at George Washington University, will link you to her op-ed, Biden, Get to Work, in the Washington Post at herenow.org. Thank you, as always.
Thank you very much.
As the national map of electoral votes fills in with red and blue, Alaska has remained a stubborn island of gray. The state has counted fewer than 60% of all the votes cast, and it didn't even start counting absentee ballots until today. As Nat Herz with Alaska Public Media reports, that's prompted confusion and questioning about the state's slow counting process.
After the state of Alaska counted a little more than half of ballots on election night, State Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins, a Democrat from the Southeast community of Sitka, is trailing his Republican opponent by 150 votes. In his House district, less than half of all votes have been counted, and Christ Tompkins is cautiously optimistic the remaining ballots should put him over the top. But in the meantime, people have been texting him with condolences for his defeat. And as co-chair of the House committee with jurisdiction over elections, he's perplexed about why the state is taking so long to count more than 100,000 absentee ballots.
Looking at the other states in the country, I do sort of have a question. Oh, like, why is it that we in Alaska don't count our absentees that have arrived prior to Election Day on Election Day?
It's not just Alaskans. People across the country have been speculating and joking about the week-long wait, including the creator of this video on the social platform TikTok that's been watched more than a million times.
What business does Alaska have waiting that long? By the time that they're done tallying all the votes there, we're going to have had like 7 new presidents and be fully submerged underwater.
Alaska's elections officials wouldn't go on tape, but they want people to know that the purpose in waiting to count absentee ballots is election security. They want to make sure they don't count an absentee ballot from a person who later goes to vote in person on Election Day. After Election Day, the state has to individually scan barcodes representing each in-person voter, then repeat the process for absentee ballots to make sure there are no duplicates. Officials say this is more of a challenge in Alaska because of its sprawling geography and dozens of communities that lack road access. The state's counting process was faster in 2016 and 2018, but Josie Bonke, who ran Alaska elections in those years, says the state is contending with a pandemic and new ballot scanning equipment this time around.
The Rural Balance Act, to balance the security and efficiency, accuracy. My heart and thoughts have been with the division these past several months, just knowing what they're up against.
Other Alaskans are criticizing this year's delay. Dermot Cole is a longtime Alaska political writer. He says the problem is only going to get more attention with the increasing popularity of mail-in voting.
This has been a trend. It's not just the pandemic year that has seen this increase in absentee ballots. So if this continues, which it will, we just need to have a better accounting system to provide both election security and prompt results.
Cole says other states have ways of protecting against double voting that allow for more ballot counting more quickly. Jonathan Christ Tompkins, the state legislator whose committee oversees state elections, says he plans to look into Alaska's absentee ballot counting system once the dust settles this year. For Here and Now, I'm Nat Herz in Anchorage.
And now you know why Alaska is still gray.
With prospects for a second term in the White House vanishing, President Trump's longtime media ally, Fox News, appears to be turning against him. And striking differences in tone across the network's schedule point to a growing divide within Fox News. Let's bring in NPR's media correspondent, David Folkenflik, who follows the industry. David, welcome. And let's start with some tape that illustrates what's going on here. Last night, Fox News host Neil Cavuto cut away from a White House press conference with Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany. Let's listen.
We want every legal vote to be counted, and we want every illegal vote to be...
I just think we have to be very clear. She's charging, the other side is welcoming fraud and welcoming illegal voting. Unless she has more details to back that up, I can't in good countenance continue showing you this. I want to make sure that maybe they do...
And then later in the evening, Tucker Carlson responded with this.
In a democracy, you cannot ignore honest questions from citizens. You're not allowed. You can't dismiss them out of hand as crazy or immoral for asking. You can't just cut away from coverage you don't like. You can't simply tell people to accept an outcome, because force doesn't work in a democracy. That's dictatorship.
David, what's going on at Fox News?
Well, what Tucker Carlson would frame as being somehow force and a dictatorship is Neil Cavuto trying to stay tethered to the facts. Now, Cavuto is an interesting creature because he's not exactly on the news side, although he's the chief business anchor. He's allowed to have points of view of things. He's been conservative over the years. But during the Trump administration, he's also been pretty reliably tethered to facts. And what you're seeing is a tension between those on the news side who are trying to gently and gingerly guide an audience that has a strong core of Trump loyalists, which is really Fox's base viewer, to the reality that Joe Biden is winning, with the opinion side, the star side, the money, the huge money-making side of Fox, the Tucker Carlsons of the world, as well as Sean Hannity, people who have been both advocates for the president on the air and advisors and friends of his off the air, who are heeding his cry, amplifying his, from what we can tell, fraudulent claims of widespread electoral fraud. And that is a tension within Fox that's playing out. And I think there's a reason for that. I think that Fox wants to retain some credibility for its news side. And I think at the same time, you're seeing a discrediting of President-elect Biden before he takes office to the extent that Republicans won't believe that he was legitimately elected.
You know, this is not the first time we've seen this fight between Fox News anchors and commentators like Carlson, who rose up with Trump, who passionately support him, who, you know, frankly, have the president's ear. We remember that former anchor Shepard Smith left the network last year. I mean, what do you think? Is this going to escalate so that we might see more departures soon in the future?
You know, I was thinking about Shep earlier in the day. Shep ultimately walked away from a contract that was something like $8 million a year, and he just said, I release you from all your financial obligations to me. I'm gone. I just don't want to do this anymore. And it was after he was attacked in some ways by Tucker Carlson over basically fact-checking the president, trying to hold the president accountable. I think that Bret Baier has been trying to thread the needle, and that is present fact. You know, you saw him a few days ago basically contradicting the chairwoman of the Republican Party, Ronna McDaniel, and saying, look, you guys keep raising questions of electoral fraud, and there's a million of examples of them on the internet, and every time we try to chase one down, there's nothing there. He said, I understand you have objections to how certain ways things worked out for certain observers, but that's very different than electoral fraud. And Eric Shawn, a reporter for Fox News, went on the air and said, look, I've talked to Republican observers. They're there watching votes be counted and Philadelphia, no matter what the Republican Party under the sway of President Trump and his campaign are saying. So you're seeing a lot of pressure being brought to bear on Fox News at very senior levels. And yet at the same time, they are very gently trying to correct the record in news. And on the opinion side, you know, there's been this torrent and unleashing of absolutely, from what we can tell, baseless claims, casting into doubt the integrity of a process overseen by, as your listeners well know, Republicans and Democrats alike.
Well, I'm watching what's happening also with the New York Post getting tougher on President Trump, referring to his claims of voter fraud as baseless as well. And of course, the Post and Fox News, both owned by Rupert Murdoch. And David, I know you've pointed out that Murdoch, yes, he may be conservative, but he's also a pragmatic business guy if his bottom line is threatened. What do you think about that? I mean, is being tougher on Trump actually good for business?
I think he wants to try to get his audiences to understand the lay of the land and to be able to intellectually register it, even if they don't emotionally accept it. And he is very capable of just dropping people like a hot potato. It's a little more complicated in the U.S., where he really has only great influence in the Republican Party. In Britain and his native Australia, he has influence in both the left and the right parties, mostly the center-left and the right to far-right. But by toggling between the two parties in those other countries, he's able to have more influence. In this case, he's just saying, you know, to the readers of the New York Post, we have to strike a different tone. It's going to not be an everyday Trump story for us in the news pages. Over on Fox, you could imagine Trump calling into Fox and Friends every day, every other day, assuming they're still on speaking terms.
Yeah. You know, you got to also believe that Fox News wouldn't actually mind a Democrat in the White House to beat up on. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you very much, as always.
You bet.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.